For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is March the 18th in Vayikra Parshas Emor. Is our last class for Emor. We should finish it tonight. Page 692. Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13. We just discussed the sin of the Mekalel, of the one who cursed Hashem, and the consequence is about to be that he's going to be stoned. We discussed last time the circumstances involving the fight that he had with the other person, and it had to do with pitching his tent in the tribe of Dan. And we said that even though the motivation of the person who tried to stop him was not the greatest, still they went to court, and Moshe Rabbeinu in court ruled against this person, against the Mekalel, the son of Shlomis Bas Divri, and as a result he cursed Hashem, and because of that he was punished. What we did not explain is that even if he lost the court case, it's pretty extreme to curse Hashem. That's a pretty big step to take. So where would we have seen that this person would have reacted that way? How to react that way is, it seems like it can't be that this is the first time this person has done anything that's wrong, because to out of the blue just behave like that, that seems to be a big jump. So Chazal say, our sages explain, that in the previous paragraph, before the paragraph about the person who cursed Hashem, on page 690, at the end of the page, we have a paragraph about the Lechem HaPanim, the showbread. And we discussed how the showbread remained on the Shulchan, remained in the open air on the table for 9 days. It was placed there on Friday, because it was baked on Friday, and then it remained there it wasn't placed there on Friday, it was placed on Shabbos, but it was baked on Friday. And it was placed on the table on Shabbos. That's when it replaced the Lechem HaPanim that was already on the table. And then it remained on the table till the following Shabbos. So that's a total of 9 days. Friday, Shabbos, and then an entire week till the next Shabbos. And it was finally eaten on the 9th day after it was baked. 8 days. It was starting with Friday. And we learned that it was one of the great miracles, in that it remained fresh, as if it had just been baked. So that was the previous paragraph. Then the Torah immediately says in Pasuk Yud, verse 10, "Vayetzei ben Yishai Yisraelis," that this son of a Jewish woman went out. He was the son of an Egyptian man, and he had this fight. And then he cursed Hashem. So, what does it mean, he went out? Vayetzei. He went out. Where did he go out from? Where did he come from that he went out and had this fight? So, Chazal say, he went out from the previous paragraph, the previous discussion. Lig leg va'amar. He scorned and said, "Is it the way of a king to eat bread that is 9 days old?" He scorned at this practice of leaving the Lechem HaPanim on the table for 9 days before it was consumed. Now, even though Hashem doesn't actually consume the bread, of course not. However, the Lechem HaPanim on the table, at least conceptually, is the food of Kedusha. It's the food of sanctity. And he said, if in fact the Lechem HaPanim represents the bread, the meal that is sanctified and used for the king, then it is inappropriate. It's wrong. It is a lack of respect to, so to speak, feed the king 9-day-old bread. You wouldn't normally do that. Now, even though there was a miracle that it remained fresh, but the practice to him seemed wrong. Therefore, he scorned at the practice. Ligleg v'amar. He scorned and he said, Derech ha-melech lechol pas chama b'chol yom. It's the way of a king to eat fresh bread every day. Shema pas tzonenes shel tisha yamim. Should he eat cold bread that's 9 days old? Doesn't make any sense. That was his reaction. He didn't do anything about that reaction. The practice of the lechem apanim remained in place and did not change. But it was a reaction. A reaction like that speaks of a person who was unwilling to accept Moshe Rabbeinu's word at face value. Moshe Rabbeinu said that this is the word of Hashem. We are to bake the lechem apanim on Friday and then leave it out for 9 days and not eat it until the following Shabbos. That was the word of Moshe Rabbeinu. This person scorned at the practice. Although that in and of itself was not what we would call a terrible aveira, he didn't do anything, he didn't stop the practice, he did not start throwing things at the Kohanim or try to somehow undermine it. All he did was scorn the practice. But that laid the groundwork so that later on, when he had the fight and ended up in the court of Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe Rabbeinu ruled against him, he couldn't accept that either. And he came out and cursed Hashem. Had he not been a scorner in the first place, then even when the cards were dealt against him and he ended up losing the court case, it is unlikely he would have then cursed Hashem. Not that he would have been happy. No one is required to be happy for losing a court case. But we are required to accept the word of Hashem. And we are required to accept that the way that the court, that the Jewish court rules, is the law. We don't have to like it, but we have to accept it. It's a hard thing to do. But a person who is already scorning at the word of Moshe Rabbeinu is certainly more likely to react in a negative way when losing the court case.
Reminds you of Korach.
Reminds you of Korach, right. Which is an important lesson in that it's, one can say, so I'll be negative, so I'll have a bad attitude. So what? I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not doing any sins. I'm not even going to speak Lashon Hara. I won't go around talking about it. Just for myself, I'll say to myself, or perhaps say to someone else who saw the same thing I did. We're not going to tell each other something we don't know. Like, so we'll just speak negatively. Nah, that's a ridiculous practice. Nah. We'll talk negatively. When people talk negatively and scorn, that in and of itself may not be the most horrific thing, but it lays the groundwork for a person to trip up in what can be a very terrible way. So it's very important that a person not find themselves in a rut where they are negative and scornful of something that is important. The Gemara tells us all types of leitzanusa, all types of scorning is prohibited. The word prohibited is a strong word. It means it's not a good thing to do. Chutz miletzanusa davar zara, with the exception of scorning idolatry. Idolatry should be scorned. Idolatry, paganism, should be scorned. It is foolish, and it should be scorned. But everything else, although it may not be what we like or what we prefer, but scorning is a dangerous road to travel. And it can easily snowball into something much worse. And that's what happened over here. He went from simply putting down the practice of the Lechem HaPanim. The Lechem HaPanim has nothing to do with his fight over the portion of land. It's two entirely different things. But he was scornful of a mitzvah of the Torah as presented by Moshe Rabbeinu, and that laid the groundwork for him to then reject what Moshe Rabbeinu says later on when ruling against him, and he reacts by cursing Hashem.
So when somebody admits guilt, so there's greater leniency for them when they admit guilt rather than holding their place and scorning and cursing?
Oh, a person doesn't have to admit guilt and still doesn't have to scorn or curse. A person could still believe that they're right and walk away. There's still a difference. Of course, if we do go to court and the court rules against us, then the appropriate thing to do is to accept it. That is the appropriate thing to do. But there still is a big difference between not liking the verdict and even being upset about the verdict and not really being happy about accepting it. There's a big difference between that and scorning and cursing Hashem. That's a big gap. And so here, the reaction shows that there was something more going on. The Medrash also tells us over here that we read in the last pasuk, the last verse of the previous paragraph, again on 692, the last pasuk Yud Beis 12, it says Vayanichu v'amishmar, they placed him in under guard, lifrosh lohem al pi Hashem, to seek out what to do by the word of Hashem. They didn't know what to do. They were not told yet the law that one who curses Hashem should be put to death. So they didn't know what to do, so they locked him up. It turns out that this story and the story that we will learn about later on in Parashas Shlach, which is the story of the Mekoshesh, of the one who violated Shabbos flagrantly, with warning, and he was also put to death. There also it says that he was put under guard. And the Gemara tells us both these stories happened at the same time. This story of the one who cursed Hashem, who was stoned, and also the story of the one who violated Shabbos, who was also stoned. They happened at the same time. In both cases, they were put under guard because the Jews didn't know something. Here, the Jews didn't know what to do at all. They did not know what is the consequence for cursing God. They weren't told yet. In the Shabbos story in Parashas Shlach, there, they knew, they had already been told that one who violates the Shabbos flagrantly is put to death. But they were not told which death. As we know, there are four different types of executions that can be carried out by the courts. And they weren't told which one is used for Shabbos, for violating Shabbos. And when they were finally told that he is to be stoned, then he was stoned. Therefore, the two were not locked up together because it was for two different reasons. One, they knew was to be put to death, but they didn't know which type of death. The other, they didn't know even that he was to be put to death. The Medrash tells us that in both cases, Moshe Rabbeinu acted patiently. Because since we were dealing with a capital crime, or at least a potential capital crime, Moshe Rabbeinu therefore did not rush to judgment and moved carefully. Whereas in other stories in the Chumash, which please God will speak about, when it was a mammonus discussion, a financial discussion, there Moshe Rabbeinu moved decisively and quickly. And the Medrash tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu was coming to teach future judges of the Jewish people to learn from him that when the court case is a monetary case, then the case needs to be judged quickly, meaning not so quickly that a person doesn't think about it well, but it should be done timely manner. Whereas a capital crime, one should not move quickly. One should definitely delay and think things through very carefully before ruling. In a financial matter, if the courts, God forbid, rule incorrectly, Reuven and Shimon are in a monetary dispute over $1,000. And in the end, they rule that Reuven owes Shimon $1,000. Hashem knows they made a mistake. Really, Reuven does not owe Shimon $1,000, and therefore it is incorrect that Reuven is being made to pay Shimon $1,000. Okay? But that's what the courts ruled. That's what has to happen. But Hashem can always reverse that. He has many ways, and he can always set things up that somehow $1,000 moves from Shimon's account to Reuven's account. One way or another, things can be worked out. Hashem has many ways of moving money around. But if the court, God forbid, puts someone to death when they were not to be put to death, Hashem is not going to bring that person back to life. Now, even though Atzur Tam and Palo Hashem is perfectly fair, and he will somehow right the wrong, but it's not going to be as simple as moving money around. And therefore, when it comes to a person's life, they have to move more slowly and more deliberately. And Moshe Rabbeinu was teaching future generations of judges that when a capital crime, one has to move deliberately and carefully. This is only up until the point where it is decided that the person is in fact Chayav Misa, that he is to be executed. Once that is decided, we do not wait. We do not believe in death row. We think that is a cruel punishment. Death row, it's far more cruel than death. For a person to sit knowing they're going to be put to death. We call that Inui Hadin, affliction of judgment. And therefore, once the ruling has come through that the person is to be put to death, then the person is put to death that same day. There is no delay. It is an immediate execution as soon as the ruling has been completed. We do require a one-night delay in completing the judgment, which means that when they're ready to vote on whether or not the person is to be put to death, we require that the court adjourns overnight, so that the judges can go through a sleepless night worried about what they're about to do to this person. So the judges will therefore come back the next morning, and after sleeping on it and after talking it over with each other, that they will come back to court and need to state emphatically, yes, I voted for death and I still maintain that he be put to death. But once that vote does take place, after they slept on it overnight, once they have the official vote, then the execution is carried out immediately. There is no delay from that point on for the execution. During that overnight delay, the Mishnah tells us that the judges are supposed to not eat or drink. They can have a little snack, but they're supposed to not indulge in anything physical, but rather they should be spending their time from the time the court adjourns until the next morning, turning the case over in their heads. The Mishnah tells us that the judges would get together informally and debate the case again in twos and threes and see if they missed something, see if there's a piece of evidence that they didn't consider carefully, see if some of the arguments that, the counter-arguments that are being put forth can win anybody over. And they barely slept that night. They came back to court the next day, all of them disheveled and having spent a very difficult several hours. And then they were told to vote. And if the vote remained for execution, then, as I said, the execution was carried out immediately. Yeah.
In waiting to say whether the person, the one who blasphemed, is there any way of doing teshuva in that waiting time?
We always require that the one being put to death does teshuva. But the teshuva cannot change the court down here. The teshuva can only change upstairs.
Okay.
That it has to be this way, that human being, the flesh and blood court, cannot be affected by considerations like the criminal doing teshuva, or what's going to be with his wife and kids. Right.
His father was Egyptian.
Right. The flesh and blood courts cannot take those things into account, because then there's no end. There's no end. And not only is there no end, there's no way for a human being to be aware of all the circumstances. Only Hashem knows all the circumstances. So therefore, the human beings, the judges, have to deal with the facts on the ground in the court case itself, and they have to ignore all of the background noise. Yikov Hadina Sahar, the judgment has to bore through the mountain, as the Gemara says. It just has to be what it is. Hashem takes everything into account. Hashem takes into account all the circumstances, the person's background, the person's state of emotional state, how he was emotionally, all the pushes and pulls on the person. Hashem takes into account the person's family. Hashem takes into account the person's friends. Everything is taken into account by Hashem. But only Hashem can do that. But from us, He expects that we use only the actual case at hand and not allow the other things to affect the judgment, both positively and negatively. Mm. Both ways. Yeah.
I forget how many judges...
You need at least a court of at least 23 judges for a capital crime. There are certain crimes for which you need 71, but generally speaking, it's 23 for a capital crime, as opposed to a monetary case, which is a court of 3. But for a financial, capital crime, it's 23.
Does it have to be a unanimous decision, or is it majority
rule? No, it's a majority rule. It's a majority rule. The way it works is that of the 23, you have to have a minimum of 13 to 10 in favor of execution in order to execute. In order to exonerate him, you only need 12 to 11 in favor of letting him off. What happens if it's 12 to 11 in favor of execution? You can't execute him because it's only a majority of 1. You need more than a majority of 1. But you can't let him off the hook either because the majority is in favor of execution. So if it's 12 to 11 in favor of execution, then they add 2 more judges to the case. Now they have 25. And they debate it again. And then they vote. And then they see what happens. In theory, those 2, if they vote the same, then one of 2 things will happen. Either, remember, we were 12 to 11 in favor of execution. If the 2 additional ones vote in favor of execution, you have 14 to 11, we execute. If the 2 additional ones vote in favor of letting him off, we now have 13 to 12 in favor of putter, of that he's free to go. Then we let him go. If they also split their vote, so we now have 13 to 12 in favor of execution, we can't execute because it's only a majority of 1, but we can't let him go either because it's still in favor of execution, we add 2 more. And we keep doing that until we end up with either more than a majority of 1 in favor of execution or a majority in favor of letting him off. That goes all the way, that can go all the way up to 71. Keep on adding 2 more and 2 more and 2 more all the way up to 71. That can happen. But one last thing is that there is an opinion that says that if it is unanimous in favor of execution, we don't execute, which is counterintuitive. And that's because the Gemara says that because they are debating and they're trying to figure out a way of letting him off and not executing, if not even one judge could think of some way of pardoning him, then they must not have done a good job. There's too many factors. We don't know everything. There's too many things that we're not aware of, and that should have made at least one judge vote in favor of letting him free. So if it is unanimous in favor of execution, then we can't kill him. But we can't let him go free either, because everybody said to execute. So again, they're going to have to re-debate exactly. And then that already is a discussion what happens at that point. Yeah.
Was there ever a story in the Gemara where there was a case that they couldn't ascend, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to intervene?
You can't. It's our responsibility. Mm-hmm. It's our responsibility. The Gemara does speak of a case of a person who was executed, or several cases, a couple of cases, a person who was executed and it was the wrong judgment. Where they actually put someone to death, and it was the wrong judgment. In one case, the judge made a mistake, and in another case, he was framed. It has happened.
So doesn't that take another night or two, rather than mamish the same date, execute him just to protect the people who are innocent?
They've already done their debating. That's the thing. The debating was already weighted towards innocence. That's what they were attempting to do, to find innocence. That was the whole point of the debate. Yeah.
Now, all this assumes, I guess, that he pleads not guilty. But what if he pleads guilty?
Right. So
do we do that?
Yeah. So we don't have a plea guilty or not guilty in court for this sort of thing. That we do have a concept that if there is a penalty. A knas, a penalty, there is a rule, modeb knas pater, someone who admits to the crime that has a penalty attached to it is not required to pay the penalty. So there are a few different penalties in the Torah that would be they would be exempt from if they plead guilty. But typically, right. Remember that even if it's true that the person committed the crime, that's not enough to put the person to death. We have other rules. The person has to have been warned. Right? There are other rules involved, and we need valid witnesses to have seen what happened. So we can't put someone to death. The Gemara tells a story of, I believe it was Shimon ben Shetach, who saw one man running after another man with a knife to kill him. And he ran after them to try to stop the criminal. The two of them ran into a deserted building. Shimon Shetach was hot on their heels. They got in there, and by the time Shimon Shetach came in, he found the victim lying on the ground, writhing and dying, breathing his last breaths, and the criminal standing with a knife, with blood dripping from the knife. So Shimon Shetach, I believe it was Shimon Shetach, said to him, "Rasha, who killed this person? It was either you or me. We both know what happened, but I can't do anything about it. The Torah says you need two valid witnesses. And even I didn't see the whole thing. I only have circumstantial evidence. But the one who gave the law will take care of this problem." And the Gemara says that within moments, a snake emerged and bit the person and killed him. So we know that Hashem is there and to take care of these things. It's not our responsibility to be perfect. It's our responsibility to do what the Torah says to do, which is to judge the case. Many times, we will not be able to put a person to death who does need to be put to death. And that's Hashem's problem, not our problem. We have to do what the Torah tells us to do.
Is there any recompense for the wife or child of somebody who was wrongly convicted?
I don't believe the Gemara speaks about that. There might be, but the Gemara does not speak about it. What the Gemara does speak about is that if someone is put to death, and we presume that it was correct to put the person to death, that the relatives of the person who was executed are required to come and give shalom to the judges, so that they are clear that they do not hold a grudge against the judges. The judges were simply carrying out the rules of the Torah, and the person had to be put to death. So
we have to take care of the widow and the orphan. So
well, okay, that's a separate issue. That's a separate issue. We don't hold it against the widow and orphan that he was a criminal. That's two different issues.
No, she's asking.
Yeah, I know, but that I don't remember the thing we were speaking about. Innocent was rare that happened. Yeah, or at least that we know about. You see, innocent, you have to know that it really was true. There are at least two cases that I know of where the Gemara says that the person had been innocent. Again, one case the person was framed, and the other case there was a mistake. In the case of the mistake, it's not that the person was, that the one who was executed did not commit the crime. He did commit the crime, and he was a Rasha, he was an evil person. But the evidence that the judge used to put him to death the judge thought was sufficient, and then the Gemara says it was insufficient. So the judge was therefore had great remorse over the fact he had put this person to death, even though the person theoretically, from Hashem's perspective, deserved it. But the court can't do it without proper evidence. And so the Gemara tells us about that particular judge that he spent the rest of his days in teshuva and in fasting over having put to death someone who he really should not have put to death. Again, we're talking about someone who did a crime, who was evil, but should not have been put to death. So the judge was overcome with grief over having put the person to death. Pasuk Yud Gimel verse 13. By the Hashem Moshe Leimor, Hashem speaks to Moshe, saying, "Hotzeis Hamikalel, take the one who cursed out, El Michutz Lamachana, to outside the camp, V'samchuchol Hashomim V'sidhem Al Rosho. All those who heard him curse Hashem should lean their hands on his head." And what they say is that we are not responsible for your death; you brought this on yourself. V'ragmu Oso Kol Ha'ida. And the entire nation shall stone him. It does not mean that everybody throws a stone. It just means that it is done in front of the whole nation. It is done, it's a public event. It is not a private matter. It is done publicly. The point of the execution is not just to remove the criminal. It is also to make everybody fear what happens to when a person behaves this way. And it is, more importantly, a matter of showing that this behavior is unacceptable behavior. That the way this person behaved results in execution. Therefore, it is a public execution.
Rabbi Pransky, why did they put his hands on his head? Because it's the same way you do smicha.
Yeah. What they're saying is this is not from us. It's similar, like when an animal is slaughtered. This is not from us. Ve'al b'nei Yisrael tadaber le'mor, and speak to the Jews, saying, Ish ish ki yekalel olokav, any man that shall curse his God, v'nasach eto, he shall carry his sin. V'nokev shem Hashem yomos yumas, someone who curses the name of Hashem, meaning the explicitly, uses Hashem's name explicitly, he shall be put to death. Ragom yergumuvo kol ha'idah, the whole nation shall stone him. Kager ka'ezrach, whether it is a convert, whether it is a... what's the word for Ezrach? It means someone native. Okay, someone who's born Jewish. Benakvo, shame you must. If they shall curse Hashem's name explicitly, they shall be put to death. Now, interestingly here, the Torah now segues into other capital crimes, and then even to crimes that are not capital crimes. V'ish kiyaka kol nefesh adam, any man who shall murder another person, most you must, shall be put to death. This is one of the Torah speaks about murder and being put to death for murder in a couple of different places. Each verse tells us something that was not mentioned in the other verse. Here, the fact that it says kol nefesh adam means that even if a person shall kill a minor, they shall still be put to death. Umakei nefesh behema, however, one who kills, who strikes and kills the soul of an animal, yishalmena, you pay for it. One does not get put to death for that. One pays for having killed an animal, meaning if the animal belongs to someone, it is their property, and if you kill somebody's animal, you have damaged their property, and therefore you have to pay for it. Nefesh tachas nefesh, a soul for a soul. Here you see clearly that a soul for a soul does not mean that you put someone to death. Because it says clearly, you shall pay money. And then it says, a soul for a soul. A soul for a soul doesn't mean you kill someone for what they did. It means you have to pay the value of the soul of the animal. A soul for a soul. You killed the animal, you pay for the animal. V'ish ki ten mum ba'amiso, a person who shall only wound his friend, so he did not kill him, he only wounded him. Kasher asa, just as he did, kenye asa lo, so shall be done to him. Shever tachas, shever, a break for a break, like a broken bone for a broken bone. Ayin tachas, ayin, an eye for an eye. Shein tachas, shein, a tooth for a tooth. Kasher yitain mum ba'adam, just as he put a blemish in a person. Kein yinas en bo, so shall be put in him. So you see in context that the eye for an eye does not mean blind the person for what he did. Because as you see from the previous verse, that when it says nefesh tachas nefesh, a soul for a soul, the Torah is saying explicitly it does not mean to kill the person, it means you pay for it. Here too, what's that?
Go back to the Goyim.
Yeah, here too it means to pay for it. If a person blinded someone, he has to pay for the eye. If he knocked out a tooth, he has to pay for the tooth. If he broke his bone, he has to pay for the broken bone. The Gemara derives from here and other places that there are five different values to pay when a person damages someone. We spoke about this in Parashas Mishpatim. There are five different assessments that are made. It is a very expensive payment. If someone, for assault and battery, there's a very, very expensive payment to be made. One that we do not have litigation in the terms of suing somebody. We don't do that in Jewish court. Rather, the assessment for what he did is made by the judges, and he has to pay that amount. He has to pay for the damage. The damage means the diminishing in value of this person. The person was worth something. Every person has a monetary value. That value is diminished because now they don't have an eye, or now they don't have a tooth, or now they don't have an arm. Whatever the damage was, that has to be paid for. That damage is assessed by using the slave market. A slave that is able to see versus a slave that is missing an eye is a huge difference in price, a very, very significant difference in price. You have to remember that a healthy slave costs a pretty penny, thousands and thousands of dollars. And one who is missing an eye loses a great deal of value. So the difference between the two, that would be the first assessment. That's one payment. Second payment is pain. We assess pain. How do we assess pain? So if a person would have to have this limb removed, the way the Gemara says it is, that let's say a person did a crime for which the secular government decided to punish that person by removing their limb, by severing their limb. So we say to that person, what would you pay to have it done under anesthesia versus not having it done under anesthesia? Most people would pay a lot of money to avoid pain. So that's a very pretty penny. It's a lot of money to pay. And that's how we assess pain. We assess pain. What would a person pay? A person who would have to go through this procedure, we can say a doctor, doesn't have to be through the government, that the person would have to have, God forbid, their arm removed. What would they pay to have it done under anesthesia rather than have it done without anesthesia? That's a lot of money. So that's number two. Number three are the medical bills. That would be all medical bills that are necessary to get the person back on their feet and healthy again, whatever that is. Without health insurance, that can be a lot of money. Number four is the loss in wages that the person incurs, meaning that the person, because they are laid up, because they're off their feet, they can't work. So what are those bills? How much are they not making because they are laid up, because they're in pain, because they're unable to work? So that's a lot of money. And the fifth one, which is the most difficult one to assess, is boshes, which is embarrassment, shame. A person who is missing a limb, there's a certain amount of shame that a person endures, and therefore that has to be paid as well. That's a difficult thing to assess. There is shame even without missing a limb. Having been struck publicly, one person slapped another person or punched another person in public, that's embarrassing. So that has to be assessed as well. That's a hard one to assess. It can be very expensive. It doesn't have to be very expensive, but it can be very expensive. So those are the five different assessments that are made, and the criminal has to pay all five things. Pasuk Chafalev, now that's in contrast to an animal. If a person kills somebody's animal, they simply pay for the loss of money. You don't have all five assessments with an animal. That's only one human being damaging another human being. Chafalev 21, Umakei behema yishalmena. If one strikes an animal, then he has to pay for it. Now that seems redundant. We just said that in Pasuk Yurchesen 18, it says if you strike the soul of an animal, you have to pay for it. So why is it repeated here in 21 in Chaf Aleph? Because in Yurchesen 18, it was talking about killing somebody's animal. And in Chaf Aleph in 21, it's talking about wounding somebody's animal. So if one person wounds another person's animal, a person owns a bull that he uses to plow his field, and another person breaks the bull's leg, that's a big loss. That's a lot of money. So he has to pay for that loss, for the damage to the bull. Umakei adam yumas. But if he strikes a person, he is put to death. And we just said before, if you strike a person and kill that person, you're put to death. So why is it repeated over here? Because this is not talking about killing a person. This is talking about striking a person. Just as the verse is talking about striking an animal, only wounding the animal, that the person has to pay for it. So too, if a person wounds another human being, they are put to death. Which human being are we talking about? That if one person wounds that person, they would be put to death. Parents. This is referring to a child wounding a parent. If a child strikes a parent and causes a wound, the child, I'm talking about a child, I don't mean a little kid. I'm talking about an adult child. But if a person strikes their mother or father and causes a wound, then that person is put to death. Wounding a parent is equivalent to killing another human being. And the son or daughter who wounds a father or mother is put to death. And that's why it is put over here, this verse, because it's contrasting wounding an animal for which one pays to wounding a parent for which one is put to death. Now, there is another reason, there are actually several reasons, but there's another reason we're going to speak about for why the wounding of a parent is juxtaposed with this statement of wounding an animal. If you own an animal that dies, and after the animal dies, I then strike the animal and cause a wound, would I owe you anything? The answer is no. What would I owe you? The animal is valueless because it died. So too, if a person's parent has died, and then the person strikes their parent and causes a wound, they would not be put to death for that. It is only while the parent is alive that if the son or daughter strikes the mother or father and causes a wound, then they would be put to death. So you say, well, isn't that obvious? I mean, why would I think otherwise? The reason why we might think otherwise is because there's something else for which a person gets put to death with their parents. If someone curses their parent, God forbid, they are put to death for cursing one's parent. They are put to death. We just spoke about cursing God, for which one is put to death. Cursing a parent, a person is put to death. And that's true even after the parent has died. Wow. Even after the parent has died, it is prohibited for a child to curse their parents. And if they do so, the punishment is capital punishment. Now again, cursing does not mean profanity. Just as we said with cursing Hashem, it doesn't mean profanity. Cursing means, may God, whatever, do such and such to you. That's what cursing is. So somehow a person would have to say that about their parent after they've passed away, which would have to be worded in a way that is relevant to someone who's already passed away. But nevertheless, whatever that formula is, cursing a parent after death, the punishment is capital punishment. As opposed to wounding a parent after death, there is no capital punishment for that. Pasuk Chavez, verse 22, Mishpat Echani Alachem, it is one law for you, Kager Kazrach, yeah, whether it be a convert, whether it be a native, it's all the same, Ki Ani Hashem Elokechem, I am Hashem your God. Rashi here puts it very succinctly, I am Hashem your God, Elokei Kulchem, I am the God of all of you, Kishem Shani Miyachet Shmi Aleichem, just as I make my name, I single out my name on all of you. I also single out my name on the converts. There's no difference between the convert and the person who was born Jewish. Chav Gimel 23, Vayidaber Moshe al Bnei Yisrael, Moshe spoke to the Jewish people, he told them everything we just said. Vayotziu es hamekalel, they took out the one who cursed, el michutz lamachana, to outside the camp. Vayirgimu oso oven, they stoned him with a stone, makes sense. Uvnei Yisrael asu kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe, the Jews did as Moshe commanded, as Hashem commanded Moshe, which means they carried out all three laws of stoning. What are the three laws of stoning? I'm sorry to talk about it explicitly. I know that not everybody's comfortable with discussion of execution, but the first step is that the person is pushed off of a two-story building onto stone, and they land on stone, which means they most likely die from the fall. That is the presumption. They will die from the fall. In the event that they do not die from the fall, then they are stoned, which means that a large stone is lifted up over them and thrown down on top of them to kill them. So that's the second step. And the third step is after the person is dead, the person is hung. Hung is not by the neck. Hung is by the arms, by the hands. The person is hung, meaning hung up from a tree, so people can see what happened. And as you know, we haven't learned this yet, but we will learn it later, that the mitzvah of hanging, which again, the term hanging is always connotes this vision of a lynching. That's not what hanging is in the Torah. It's a person who's already dead, only with stoning, not the other types of execution, only stoning. That the mitzvah is that the person then be hung from a tree using their arms, not their neck. And the mitzvah is that the person is not allowed to be left hanging overnight. Therefore, what was typically done, how often was a person executed? But when it did happen, they killed the person, they hung them up, and then immediately took them down. They did the mitzvah, it's done, now you take them down and you bury them. And that was done. The person who was executed was buried in a separate graveyard, not in the graveyard of their family, but there was a special graveyard for those executed by the court, which was an embarrassing thing, that the person should be placed there. That the person was kept there for a year until the body had decomposed, and then the body was exhumed and moved to the family grave.
Now, I have two questions. When someone's a convert, why do we keep mentioning it?
Why over here? Because this person was from a Jewish mother and non-Jewish father.
But so other than that, a good convert is a Jew.
Yeah. That's why. But the reason why it's being emphasized over here is because we're dealing here with someone. Yeah.
So this was in the desert. In the Mecca.
Yes.
So did they take him along, or they left him buried there?
No, they buried there. Other people died in the Midbar. That's life. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.